This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
My title is borrowed from an inadvertent remark of the poet, vexing the diptych with asymmetry. We can have the first pair. And focus on the left, please. To paint diptychs, paintings on paired panels or canvases, means not only not painting paintings of a single panel, but not painting triptychs, let alone cycles or series of more than three. The different implications of the diptych and the painting as singular field on a single ground, which has long been primary, are more obvious than the difference between diptychs and triptychs. So I want to begin by accounting the triptych as something more drastic for painting than simply a liberating shift from duality into plurality. Putting the matter this way already tends to eliminate mural painting, with its tradition of multiple images and cycles and registers, though not necessarily the codex format, allowing of double page spreads in a book. Let us then consider what Marjorie Welsh's painting entails by definitely not being a matter of triptychs, let alone polyptychs, and certain structural possibilities thereby accruing, with possible devices, in that good old Russian formalist word. What seems implicitly wrong with the triptych format, from the Welsh point of view, is its hopeless openness to pictorialism. Perhaps a good way to start is to note that Marjorie and I happen to have a peaceable but endless dispute provoked one day, years ago, when walking on East 125th Street near the railroad station in Harlem, when I pointed to an instance of the standard so-called Palladian window in a second-story facade and said that in my view of art history, linear diffusion is not so much the point as the immense web of connections between all instances of anything, including all those somehow linking the late 19th or early 20th century window on 125th Street with Lord Burlington's definitive Neo-Palladian Chiswick house of 1725. While speaking, I have, of course, been showing an authentic pseudo-Palladian window, as Witkover insisted it be called, because it is something that Palladio himself never did, namely a window of Burlington's Chiswick house in London, seen from inside the house and divided ABA into minor flat-headed, major round-headed, and minor flat-headed lights. Burlington's window gives a view of the equally definitive English garden or jardin anglais, thoroughly designed by William Kent. And I would maintain that the very triptych-like structure advances a peculiarly appropriate sense that what one beholds is literally picturesque, deliberately looking pretty as a picture. Indeed, the disposition of all one can survey from the window is highly calculated, with actual artistic models in mind. Now, the view, especially Confucian Gardens and the paintings of Claude, by the way. Now, the view of such an unnaturally artful nature would just not be so effectively picturesque if framed by a pair only of rectangular lights. At the same time, picturesque seems not such a good thing for a modern painting, at least, to be. By the way, I am deliberately not summoning up the old red herring of the Albertian window trope, having already written elsewhere on Leon Battista Alberti never really pronounced that a painting should necessarily be like a window into illusionistic space. That's another story. Beside one of the world's most definitive Neo-Palladian, that's a style, pseudo-Palladian, that's a type, windows, I show an Attic black-figured vase painting of five women at a well, circa 520 BC, in the Museum of Fine Arts, Boston. This is a good place to open the question of diptychs versus triptychs, in that the division of the pictorial field into three zones by two columns, welcoming the inference of a continuous pictorial space behind, is almost exhibitionistically vain, where at the left, the second woman supposedly just happens to be caught behind a column, while the only interesting thing for the spectator is to wonder why then the third and fourth figures should instead happen to line up against the column between them. That is, if the non-occlusion at the right is more or less contrived. What matters here is that regrettably, we moderns would tend to say, the game of compositionally canned pictorial scenes, a term tellingly parasitic on the drama, is already well underway. There is much evidence to support the claim that the tripartite structure of the triptych serves the dubious cause of the picture in the worst sense. And a picture, it is necessary to say, because a painting by Marjorie Welsh presents itself forthrightly as an image, a distinct and complete visual construct, but never a picture. As Marjorie is aware, this distinction, well established among New York School painters of the abstract expressionist generation, has tended to go by the boards, especially since 20 years ago, the money people started perversely affecting an Anglophile dilettante embrace of pictures in the auction room sense. Next on the left, please. Without pretending to survey the development of the altarpiece of triptych or three-paneled form, it can be noted that in Domenichino Veneziano's St. Lucy altarpiece of the Madonna and Child with Saints, 1440 to 42, a tripartite division by columns into three architectural bays plays similarly against the division of the image into three, as in all altarpieces where a central subject from the New Testament or the life of a saint is flanked by saints and or donors on separate wings, physically hinged to the central panel. Here, by having the social form of a metaphoric sacra conversazione, which semiotically cutting across the generations, because these people are not contemporaries in historical time, establishes a typically Italianate classical metaphysical unity, advancing a naturalistic unification of space. Such unifying pictorialism is, however, by no means necessarily advantageous from a modern point of view, in that it works to compromise sign value in favor of a supposedly natural, purportedly unconcocted nature. Next on the right, please. The triptych with hinged wings is a common format for Flemish altarpieces, with a definite tendency to have pictorial space spill with naturalistic consistency between the main field and wings. In the Robert Campan Marot altarpiece of about 1425, an Annunciation in the cloisters, there is a witty sense of exterior and interior context as both related to the chamber containing the Archangel Gabriel and Mary, in the sense especially of the door punning on the hinge of the altarpiece. It's the hinge of the door and it's also the hinge of the altarpiece. Next on the right, please. In Joachim Pattenier's altarpiece of circa 1518, also in the Metropolitan, with a central panel of the Penitence of St. Jerome and also many other such works, there is instead an extensive landscape setting, all pretty much of a pictorial space. The ordinariness of the natural world, just interestingly enough, if you like things interesting instead of beautiful, keeps flowing metonymically, oblivious to the physical splice. A little sharper on the right, please. actually, we can use the next one on the right, too, so you might as well just focus that. Good. When in the Baroque, Rubens inherits this very format, his grand figural compositions, such as the Raising of the Cross, 1609-10 in Antwerp Cathedral, manage to maintain a sense of subordination of the wings. This has wings with two saints each, plus assorted other figures, in settings having some continuity with the main image, yet disjunct from its action. Next on the left, please. Though the initial sketch for the altar, this is not the sketch, but I should complete the sentence here. Though the initial sketch for the altarpiece was without it wings. So what you're looking at is a close-up of the central panel of the finished painting, although the original sketch for the painting did not include the conception of wings. 25 years ago, by an amazingly solid argument, next on the right, please, Alan Bernholtz showed that Rubens' main composition, with its powerfully thrusting diagonal, inspired the important Kazimir Malevich suprematist painting of 1917, Amsterdam Stedelijk Museum, in which the three transverse arcs overlaying the hefty diagonal derive from the crossbar and tilted figure with shorter transverse axes of Rubens' Raising of the Cross. Bernholtz's study appeared just as we were also learning how Russian modernist interest in the Orthodox icon had been piqued by the cleaning of the old paintings in the early years of the 20th century. Next on both sides, please. Natalia Goncharova, for one, did set and costume designs, next to the right, please, based on the essentially diptych-like royal doors, as they're called, of the iconostasis separating sanctuary and nave in Orthodox churches, for a projected Ballet Russe work entitled La Liturgie, rehearsed in 1915 but then abandoned. This is Goncharova on the right. That's a real pair of royal doors on the left. Yet the tropism of the triptych for more or less naturalistic pictorial continuity is evident in its mobilization as a device in early modern photography of decidedly pictorialist cast. Next on the left, please. With actual vertical cuts, fractures in the image, and as far as I know, untitled work of F. Holland Day from circa 1899 was not unique. And while the device seems to tender an image that is arty and artificial in the sense of like art, because like painting, the kind of painting on which it is parasitic was a naturalism itself trying to be poetic, i.e., quasi-symboliste. Next on the right, please. Whatever the continuities between symboliste spiritualism and expressionism, even expressionist painters, and long before Francis Bacon, might fall back on the triptych format. Eric Heckel's triptych Convalescence of Woman, 1913, in the Bush Reisinger Museum at Harvard. A little sharper on the right, please. Okay, that's all right. Does something quite this worldly with it, setting up a continuum yet breaking it down by quasi-animism of nature into an ABA sequence of potted plant, reclining figure in the positively passive state of convalescence, and sunflower blooms like therapeutic sun lamps in a kind of spiritualistic secular altarpiece. Next on the right, please. Yet, the very strength of the naturalistic presumption is, for example, what Bernice Abbott structurally engaged and constructivistically overcame by using the vertical forms of two steel beams to break into three panels, altarpiece-like, in being narrower, wider, narrower, of a triptych-structured photo mural at the Museum of Modern Art in 1932. Next on the right, please. By comparison, the carefully split Rocky Mountain Sublime landscape photograph pasted onto Mies van der Rohe's famous project drawing of 1938 for the Resler House in Wyoming is quite standardly naturalistic as a setup for a structure exquisitely dematerialized, not to mention the trans-naturalistically sublime structural conviction 10 years later of Barnett Newman's classic paintings. So much for now for the perennial triptych, the reason why it lends itself to pictorialism being its readiness to facilitate a continuity that may seem only incidentally interrupted in comparison with the split between halves of a diptych as an undeniable caesura. But before the triptych took off on its career, late antiquity had offered a format more integrally engendering of plays of similarity and opposition. That of, next, on both sides, please. That of the so-called consular diptych, which played its part in the Byzantine prehistory of the Orthodox icon that would be rediscovered by the Russian moderns and then rediscovered by us in the 1970s. By analogy with the ancient diptych type, Marjorie's recent resort to the diptych format can begin to be seen as more than holding out against the relative pictorialism of a triptych, the basis of a fine-grained structural ingenuity. Next, we have them, thank you. Rejecting the triptych as such with its pictorialist connotations in Marjorie's name, pictorial structure, just say no. I want to dilate on the more welcome structural implications of the diptych, as founded on these examples in shallow ivory relief of late Roman into Byzantine times, as pairs of panels, at first book covers, related as braces by identity, similarity, and or opposition. They emerged in the late 4th century, serving as imperial gifts manifesting imperial authority after the subdivision into four of imperial rule, especially after the death of Constantine. Consular diptychs actually come in a variety of types, only some of which are consular or other imperial portraits, but most of which admit of either doubling, including doubling with some elements or elements, somehow reversed, or binary opposition. While the format itself proves surprisingly open to categorical substitution, whether pagan or Christian, secular or sacred, even concrete or abstract. In a late 4th century diptych in Liverpool, Asclepius and Hygienia personify medicine and hygiene, that's on the left, though the equal and opposite structural relation of a serpent exomorphically spiraling around the rough wood staff of the one and an otherwise like like a serpent endomorphically unfolding itself like a fire hose from within a metal tripod beside the other, is more to the artistic point. In another famous late 4th century example on the right, now split between the Musée Cluny and the Victoria and Albert, two priestesses are seen respectively performing pagan rites, and had only the right half been found, understood to represent specifically a marriage rite, something otherwise similar but different, say something to do with marriage but civic, or some other sort of sacrifice altogether, as here, might have turned up as the lost half. Next on the left, please. In one remarkable 5th century case in Vienna, personifications of Rome and Constantinople present themselves as a categorical pair of imperial capitals, analogous but different, equal and opposite, Miss West and Miss East, as differently but comparably, next on the right, please, in Islamic manuscript illuminations with paired views of the two Muslim holy cities, here in a work of 1739-40 in the Museum for Kunsthandwerk at Frankfurt, with Medina and Mecca appearing almost stereoscopically similar. Another on the right, next on the right, please. Another 5th century diptych in the Monza Cathedral treasury is all the more remarkable on behalf of our painter-poet for showing a poet and muse. Here the male poet sits passively attentive in a worldly manner with legs casually crossed, while the female muse not only stands statuesquely but presses actively forward as if in unruffled uniform like a proper express delivery person. How easy, thinking of our female poet, it would be to effect a substitution in respect to gender without compromising the structure, as perhaps by some play on the terms anima and animus. The flexibility of structure that would allow of such substitution is just the reason why, when one half of a consular diptych is missing, there can be a reasonable sense of what the missing half should look like, buffered by a skepticism that something about it will prove not simply like unto at all, but rather like as equivalently different. I realize that for a generation now, structuralism as such has been criticized for schematizing reality into seemingly just the kind of closed equational structures framed in terms of polarities, as I seek to elucidate here. And this must be relevant in the present context if we are to see the ancient diptychs in light of Welish's, or vice versa. Although I tend not to wish to abandon art in its physical presence, I can at least remind all concerned that it is quite possible for art to stand critico-respectably in Schopenhauerian compensatory disjunction with life rather than metonymic continuity or reflexive relation with it. It is even possible that there is something as universal, or at least as universally accessible in art, as there is in, say, chess, without it being reactionary to pursue such a thing. But next on both sides, please. Further examples of the variety of ways that the consular diptych game could be played include such a subtle equation of differences as a double image of Boethius as consul on the left from 487 in the Museo Cristiano of Brescia, where standing figure and seated figure are equated in a curious post-classical isocephaly. So it's the same guy, seated and standing, but equal in height. Horizontal division of the panels offers one of the more conspicuously Welish-like categories of variation, such as in the panels of Probianus' Vicar of Rome. I think that's coming up on the left. Yes, thanks. On the left, please. No, but it's all right. Where a hierarchy of size in the miniaturized... Yes, right. Where a hierarchy of size in the miniaturization of subsidiaries to the throne figures above extends to medium-sized burners of incense below deck. Oh, here it is, there. In another 5th century example at Brescia, members of the official family looked down from a balcony upon chariot racing below. Finally, a much later example in this tradition, next on the right, please. Yeah, good. A much later example in this distinguished tradition in the borderland between sculpture and painting, purportedly of the 10th century, has a rather Welish-like differentiation of panels into three bands each, but as much as refusing to jibe. It should be apparent in view of these various examples that the doubled, couplet-like presence of the paired ivory panels, wood panels, or stretched canvas foregrounds the formal role of image structure, as with regular metric forms in poetry. And is there not something marvelous in the fact that one might find a damaged manuscript of an unpublished poem and, lacking the end of a certain line, make quite reasonable inferences about the sound of a missing word without even knowing what the word was? Next on both sides, please. Considering these matters from a structural rather than antiquarian point of view, it strikes me that side by side with the complete setup of Giovanni Bellini's 1488 altarpiece on the left, with Saints Nicholas and Peter in the left-hand wing and Benedict and Mark on the right, the pair of orphaned altarpiece leaves dating from about 1523-26 in Munich, the so-called Four Apostles by Dürer, an admirer of Bellini, always looks only the more punchy, seen cheek by jowl, with Peter and John at the left and Paul and Mark at the right, doing quite anti-pictorially well, thank you, without an intervening narrative panel. Next on the left, please. And one cannot raise this question in this city without saluting the splendid diptych by Roger van der Weyden of the Crucifixion with the Virgin and Child and St. John the Evangelist from the earlier 1450s in the Philadelphia Museum. With triptychs, the plurality of the tripartite might seem to promise a beneficial openness, but it proves all too easy to have figural side panels facilitate naturalistic consistency in the principal scene by a merely conventional openness. Better the forthright clash of structures showing structure forth as such, as in the amazing Philadelphian Crucifixion, in which the active diagonal sagging and lifting of earthly bodies and hearts on one side is countered by the centrality formality, and except for the rustling ends of Christ figure's drapery, the timeless stasis of the cross and corpus at the right, in a kind of equal and opposite balance of asymmetric differentiation. Next on the right, please. Yes. How Roger's red cloth of honor hangs, leaving wide even bands, borders of gray stone, and across both panels' tops, black, can be likened to the play of broad and narrower bands of color, including black, in orthogonal interplay of such a work by Marjorie as The Without One of 1999. Next on the left, please. It happens that for some years before arriving at her definitive diptych format, Marjorie produced paintings on four canvases, in which there are top-to-bottom shifts, displacements and doublings, as well as left-right discontinuities. The High Valley number 13 of 1982 being an example. Back then, around the turn of the 70s, one might have justified this as a painting by emphasizing its large pattern section as decorative, it's supposedly being a prerogative of women's art to indulge a polymorphous perverse hysteria of surface ornamentation over and against supposedly all the compulsive centering of attention in guy-painted painting. The trouble was, and unfortunately still is, that the decorative articulation of a literally flat surface was the great plateau of post-impressionism, attained by 1890 with the final elimination of illusionistic space. But this elimination of the false old pictorial space in virtue of an affirmative decorativeness shared with the applied arts at the turn of the century was not enough, neither for expressionists who bridled at the anesthetic tendency to idealize a passively pacific surface, nor, more consequentially, for the cubists. Next on the right, please. Negating the false old space was certainly not enough for Braque and Picasso. Notwithstanding, or in spite of, its two-dimensional limitation, painting must be capable of engendering a new, non-illusionistic structure of space, not a given scaffold, but a space elicited in consequence of intersections of the forms of things, interference patterns, as it were, of edges as constituting a virtually crystalline structure entailing space. For example, in Picasso's early Nude Woman, a beautiful charcoal analytical cubist drawing assigned to 1910 by the Museum of Modern Art, edges as frontiers of extension in the philosophical sense assume new importance as constituting a construct in this conception. Although the question of Immanuel Kant in relation to cubism is complex, I want to point out that in the Critique of Pure Reason, Kant nullifies the presumption of space and time as objective conditions in part by offering that the claim that with, quote, two straight lines alone, no figure is possible, close quote, cannot, quote, be derived from the concepts involved, close, but must, as ever in geometry, depend on intuition as itself formed by a, quote, universal a priori condition under which alone the object of outer intuition is itself possible. Kant is busy explaining the self-evidence of the idea that with, quote, two straight lines alone, no figure is possible. And we cannot pretend we missed the point. But how shall it matter if actuality flies in the face of agreed impossibility? Next on the left, please. Kant must have been unaware of a caricature by Hogarth in which two lines only, A, B, constitute a describable figure. True, there is a third line, a curve, C, but it does not compromise the case because it is disposable. By simple adjustment of the title, which is A Man Carrying a Rifle Leaving a Tavern with a Dog, those of us of a certain age will recall that the visual pun by Hogarth adumbrates the sight gag drawings done live on 1950s television by the cartoonist Roger Price. While Hogarth's drawing obviously consists of three lines, whereas two lines only would be specified, the third line, a curve, could be handily negated to satisfy Kant's specification, most simply by amending the promise of the title from A Man Carrying a Rifle Leaving a Tavern with a Dog to a prosaic Man Carrying a Rifle Leaving a Tavern, or, in something like the way Mae West said, if you're really good at it, to A Man Carrying a Rifle Leaving a Tavern Ahead of His Dog. There would not have been sufficient visual wit for the joke were it not for the counting in of the punningly concrete door jamb edge as a spatial disjunction or caesura indicated by the single vertical line. Nor without a basic sense that the same feature might semiotically occlude the other two. Had Hogarth been around to respond to Kant, he might have one-upped him by drawing his single diagonal along the right-hand edge of a sheet of paper, capitalizing on the edge as the line for his door jamb and doing the job with one line alone. Next on the right, please. And I would add that there is something left of Hogarth's witty play on the inner edge idea, as well as a cubistic play on the concreteness of letters as signs in Jasper John's field painting of 1964. Next on the left, please. An example of Welsh's earlier four-panel works that puts me in mind of the little Hogarth caricatura in Light of Kant. In The High Valley No. 8, 1982-83, which is already diptych-like in the primacy of its split into left and right more than top and bottom halves, red diagonals meet up as angles, not only with the upper edge of the whole, but with such an internal edge as occurs between the abutted panels of the left-hand diptychly leaf, and this relation of side of triangle to edge of panel plays on line as limit of material extension and line as pertaining to surface. In the later 1980s, Welsh's four-canvas format became a transitional diptych in that its two leaves, while no longer structurally divided each in two, top and bottom, in the sense of physical structure, were still or only all the more structurally so divided. Next on the right, please. Thus, 7 or 8 years later, in Small Higher Valley No. 9, 1994-95, one panel of the diptych is dominated by a clash between two broad-banded tricolor areas, a vertically banded atop a horizontally banded, consisting of two different yellows and two different blues, with a kind of wipe between, while the other panel harbors a complexly checkered area that loosens up into its lower left half to make for a large plane area subdivided by line into complementary geometric and organic forms. But I wish to elaborate on this construct at the left of this painting, which is very characteristic of Welsh's sense of, one wished there were a better word than pictorial, how about imagic, structure, which seems to me to partake of the sometimes amazing structural astuteness of early Cubist collage, but precisely as pure painting. Next on the left, please. For elucidation, in one of Picasso's best early collages, The Bowl with Fruit, Violin, and Wine Glass of 1912 in the Gallatin Collection here in the Philadelphia Museum, something has long struck me as one of the most structurally decisive and intellectually exciting 20th century moves in the game of painting. I speak not of the witty substitution of real graphic illustrations of fruit for conjured fruit surrogates to suit the flat stand-in for a compote at the upper left, which I always suspect might have been cut from that all-American monument of turn-of-the-century color printing, Beach, Booth, and Taylor's two-volume 1905 The Apples of New York, but I won't go on about that. No, I must particularly mean Picasso's non-representational papier-collé construct in the lower left. There, by some combination of ink brush-like painting and cutting, rotation and overlapping the brush black brushed paper, Picasso has produced a row of even, neatly brushy black stripes alternating with wider spaced blanks in between, like blacks and whites on a piano keyboard. Then by a single transverse tear, careful but apparently freehand as torn after folding, the now bifurcated strip of capital T's is rotated 90 degrees and turned back on itself, producing at left a capital E.
Here the very materiel of written language is concretized, but though linguistic in an extrapolated sense, this is utterly nonverbal as those eye charts for preliterate children consisting of all capital E's variously rotated. Moreover, just as nonverbally but more linguistically, an algebraic equation of sorts is hinted at by the same cut and rotation, E equals 2T. Brilliant in the context is the cubist overlap whereby one sign is made only the more concrete as sign under impingement or impact of another, of an otherwise insignificant corner of white from the T row over the central prong of the E, making it only the more properly typographical, a Roman capital. Next on the right, please. From among any number of works by Marjorie proffering comparable devices, I show for its associations with the constructivism that developed out of cubism, a collaborative drawing, Vogue Project Number 1, made as visiting artist at the Artist Museum at Vogue in Poland in 1997 in collaboration with Jerzy Gregorski. This was the first of 16 pieces in which Welisch painted on heavy paper, and in each case, Gregorski responded to her drawing by drawing an overlay and charcoal on tracing paper. In the present instance, however, her composition by subdivision into quarters, thirds, and halvings with displacement in black bands against white paper alone comes close to the structure of Picasso's E equals 2T device. Next on the left, please. As Marjorie has made no secret of her respect for just the constructivist tradition that more young Polish artists would nowadays do better to respect, I show an example rather more concrete than her own, which also relates to the Picasso device. Composition 1932 by the Polish constructivist Hendrik Strzeziewski, who died only in 1988. With Władysław Strzemiński, at just about the moment he painted this work, Strzemiński was articulating unism, it was called, as a way of transcending the limitations of composition in the traditional sense, even in purely non-objective art, of the artful subdivision of a still all pictorial field. The present example has two rectangular fields of smooth white, fused and breaking up a surrounding white field, distinguished only by the peaking facture of its brushwork in larger and smaller, though still quite non-relational areas. Next on the right, please. By no means out of character with it is such a work as Small Higher Valley No. 8 of 1994, in which Relish both allows of a substantial areas of white and makes a point of the coexistence of two factures, a weak brushiness, especially in the white, and a plainer fullness in the yellow and red. Next on the right, please. Yet because Marjorie is simply not a neoconstructivist painter, it seems worth looking into later cubism as well. Picasso's great Girl Before a Mirror, 1932, in the Museum of Modern Art, is obviously more affected by surrealism than Zizevsky's all-white abstraction of the same year, though many a surrealist could appreciate the sheer extremism of Zizevsky's compositional differentiation by facture alone. Next on the left, please. Let us juxtapose with the audaciously complex Girl Before a Mirror a comparably, twin-lobed, split, diptych-like composition by Matisse, Odalisque with Tambourine, of 5 years earlier, 1927, in Pasadena. When he painted this odalisque, Matisse had already painted the better-known Moorish screen, 1921, in Philadelphia, whose informal composition of two women with the same screen behind them has none of the diptych-like bifurcation featured here. In the Pasadena odalisque, Matisse's figure rather smooths over the fact of a hinge between panels of the deep indigo ornamentally patterned screen. This seems conservative, naturalistic in its presumption of coherent contiguity before the great Girl Before a Mirror, in which Picasso elaborates a brassy, percussive, coloristically clashing complex consisting not only of the self and self-image of the young lady contemplating her own anatomical bodiliness, but also accompanying inflections of the common context of the figure or pair of figures. The second use of the word figure is in the figurative sense, the painting, since it's the same person. The percussive rhythms of the double-figured patternistic backup shift raucously without missing a beat in the trellis-like wallpaper pattern of lozenges picked out with circle in each. Here red as pattern, there as ground. Here and there green doubling with black, as if in jazzy warble against the blaring Van Gogh-like yellow ground. It's just too simplistic to go along with the notion that, in effect, the decorative colorism of Matisse is bodily and feminine, and that that's either good enough for gals to identify with, or else for guys to bag as their proper quarry, leaving, funny thing, Picasso the brain, as ever, the artist genius. So I want quickly to make two points. A, that this, that in this work so charged with the notion of male creativity as compensation for the unfathomable mystery of childbearing, notwithstanding Picasso's analytical penetration of the figure's own penetrating self-regard, what Matisse produces is not just a pretty face, but also B, that the structural articulateness of Marjorie's painting is more like the girl before a mirror than the odalisk with tambourine anyway. Excuse me. Certainly the Marjorie Welles, who often elects to work with two reds and two yellows or blues in one diptych, has something structural in common with the Picasso, who seems here to double and treble the structural interest of his so coloristically constituted pattern. For nothing in all this is more relevant to the hyperstructural art of Welles than the way Picasso supercharges that grid, which might have remained just so much on-rolling wallpaper pattern as supposedly decorative, hence secondary. Ever since the late 19th century post-impressionism, the decorative had been favorably contrasted with the pictorial, which is still true as far as it goes, but as cubism made evident, and Welles seems evidently aware, on the farther side of the decorative is the structural. Yet Matisse himself is also seen to have been manifestly capable of building up an image structure of coloristic differentiation, next on the left, please, in respect to the skewed grid of a textile pattern, a seemingly cast over a figure in her clothing like a unifying net. In fact, in Woman with a Veil, also of 1927, Museum of Modern Art, he had more reservedly shifted colors beneath a similarly skewed grid, if without as fully integrating them with it, in colored grid and a color quartering of the figure. Here Matisse's seated figure sits frontally, legs centrally crossed, with head upon hand and elbow upon knee, like a Renaissance Melancholia. The quadrants of her over-shoulder scarf and skirt both split left and right while affiliated by overlay of diagonal grid of yellow lines. This yellow pattern is indeed a grid, but its being uppermost in the surface gives it no structural priority. Rather, as with the tick of a metronome in front of music, its division of the surface only heightens a play of structural differences going on underneath. For the left-hand half of the draped figure only counts as two quadrants of red, i.e. a vertical pair of red sames, because the right-hand quadrants are both different, what with the upper right green and the lower right black. And let us note in passing that Matisse's active engagement of black as a color is one of the more significant practices on the way from Manet to Welles. Next on the right, please. The structure of Matisse's quartered figure is so engaging in its overlapping equations of identity and difference that it should remind many of my generation of a diagram from Claude Levi Strauss. The diagram was, to begin with, a drawing on paper by a native artist of the Cadúvero people in Brazil of a face painting of traditional sort. The diagram was, to begin with, a drawing on, yes, Levi Strauss first discussed it during the war as the first in the first issue of the New York avant-garde, especially surrealist, art magazine VVV in 1942, then again in Twist Tropique, 1955, and also in an essay on split representation in the art of Asia and America in Renaissance for 1944-45, published in New York by the exile École Libre des Hautes Etudes, and later collected in Structural Anthropology. When I saw it in this last source, 1958, and wrote a little about it in an amateur structuralist essay by me on New Abstract Painting in Art Forum for 1979, November 1979, I had not yet, titled Nothing, Not Nothing, Something, I had not yet read Jameson's Prison House of Language, where the same item is embedded in a critique of structuralism as showing apparently incompetently, quote, art as a working out in formal terms of what a culture is unable to resolve concretely. That might sound innocent enough, in that art has often managed, if not always explicitly, to engage, to deal indirectly or by sublimation at least with matters of social as well as individual life, including mortality. But Jameson is disappointed that art doesn't affect social contradictions, only as, quote, an articulation on the level of the signifier, of a signified which is essentially felt to be an antinomy or a contradiction. It is now a long time since Jameson described structuralist binary opposition as, quote, a kind of arrested dialectic, the projection of a multidimensional concept into a world of plane surfaces. But in painting, there is little to build up an image with, representational or not, on the singular plane surface besides oppositions and distinctions, especially if we consider the whole matter of complementary colors binary. Something that deserves to be affirmed is the generally overlooked socialization value of even non-objective painting, even if it's in its more analytically demanding forms, as offering intensive occasions of shared sympathetic cognition. Without implying that it need bear the whole weight of a defensive structuralistic abstraction, I think it is only fair to credit Welisch's work in painting with problematizing structural thinking as happily mind-engaging in that it welcomes cognition about visual formal conjunctions of color and form and rewards it with honest delight. Relatedly, the checkering that occurs in many of Welisch's paintings is not really so much a question of grid painting as it is a generative structure of mutually negative mutual definition, white squares being nothing but non-black ones, independently of any grid lines that may or not be present in between. It may be significant that all checkering seems complete in a markedly asymmetric condition. I should read that sentence over. It may be significant that all checkering seems complete in a markedly asymmetric condition, starting with a dark or light unit and ending the row with its opposite. Next on the left, please. Whereas grids purport to be endless symmetries, at least in the mathematical or musical sense, in which A, B, A, B is a symmetry. In an article entitled Hardcore Painting in Art Form for 1978, I reproduced a checkered diagram from Goethe's Farbenlehre in 1810, a diagram that soon recurred in Rosalind Krauss's essays on the pictorial grid, starting a year later. But Goethe wasn't really talking about the grid, for in a sense there is only one, the grid, and neither was I, any more than I have concentrated here on Matisse's yellow grid, as, if anything, decoratively passive vis-a-vis the fascinating, almost heraldic quartering that it overlaid. Inspired by then-contemporary abstract painting, I was trying to get at something about the dialectic of visual structure. When the checkerboard structure reminds us of the game of chess, we are thereby reminded of a game that no player will ever dismiss as formalism. It is enough to recall the great respect of not only surrealists but the Russian formalist Viktor Shklovsky for the knight's move in particular. Besides the knight's move as signifying political astuteness, Shklovsky also writes in his introduction to The Knight's Move, 1923, a collection of essays published between 1919 and 21, there are many reasons why the knight moves this way, and the most important of them, the conditionality of art. I am writing about the conditionality of art, he says. The sheer limitations of all planar formats and the chemical and optical limitations of color are all certainly conditional in painting. Next on both sides, please. But I'm not quite finished. I want to offer a little coda concerning form and architecture, specifically the early modern architecture of Adolf Loos, for even one's obsessions can be portals to wisdom. For I am struck by certain formal parallels implying similar attitudes toward form as a matter of interrelated orthogonal subdivision, whether in Marjorie's painting or in the plastic slicing through of a wall, breaking its bulk into boxy, closed, and open volumes in Loos's architecture. Certainly some compositional similarity obtains between the long, transverse wall of what we Americans would call the living room of Loos's 1930 Villa Müller in Prague and such a composition by Marjorie as The Without, 6 of just last year, 2001. No need to spell this out in descriptive detail when it is enough to remark a totality-to-totality equivalence, despite the different circumstances between the flat wall as cut through irregularly but everywhere rectilinear and orthogonal, especially as silhouetted against dark and light areas behind in the head-on photograph, and the rectilinear and orthogonal articulation of the uncompromisingly flat imagic composition in painting. One of the recurrent motifs of Marjorie's paintings, however, a certain L-shaped or gamma form, is a structural motif with especially interesting architectural counterparts that by comparison show up formal significance, even, dare one say, formal poetry, as against a structural neutrality, sometimes positively anti-formalist, found not only in functionalist architecture but in materialist constructivist painting and sculpture. The same recent diptych just cited makes a point of the symmetries and asymmetries obtaining between several yellow or white gamma forms and their upper to lower and left to right affiliates that reminds me, next on the left please, of an interesting late work by Loos His double semi-detached houses built as municipal housing in the Werkbundsiedlung on the western outskirts of Vienna, 1930 to 32. But lest this be considered an idle association on my part, I hasten to add that to my best recollection, the photograph of the Loos project which we are looking at was actually taken by this artist as well as poet whom we honor today. There is general precedent for the Wellish gamma form in the architectonic gamma formed where an L-shaped wall opening develops because a rectangular opening is partly blocked by a smaller rectangular solid. Not unlike the way the Polish constructivist composition of Stajewski from 1932 already invoked, but also not unlike, next on the left please, in a classic example, the shop fronts of the ground floor of Bramante's so-called House of Raphael in the High Renaissance. Note two, next on the left please. Note two, in a drawing by Palladio of the corner of the same house, how that highly plastic architect was also interested in how a lefty version of the form pairs up a la Wellish with a righty around the corner. Some such forms are, to be sure, artlessly aformal, even if not utterly inadvertent. Thus, two Czech functionalist examples, left please, that seem happy not to make any formal fuss. A 1921 design by Jaroslav Frogner and a row of garden city minimum dwellings near Luni, northwest of Prague. Next on the left, please. By the architect and photographer Josef Hasenblas, built in 1929. In other words, I don't find these formally significant, but I'll be very swift here because I'm relying on the visual evidence. But in turning from these houses to Loos's little houses, next on the left, please. But in turning from these, in other words, those functionalist examples, to Loos's little houses, the same ones you saw in the color photograph, especially in photographs of them in the raw while under construction, it is striking to see, next on the left, please. It is striking to see how engagingly symmetry and asymmetry are negotiated by Loos in major and minor gammas, not to render the facade in any sense decorated, but to accord it a visibly intelligent formal articulation. While with the Villa Müller, Loos was permitted to work much more expensively than the house's unostentatious exterior plainness might suggest. Here, he was no doubt working under economic constraint on a tight budget. Talk about the Shklovskian conditionality of art, which is quite relevant here in terms of the Knight's Move, and especially for their deployment of the Knight's Move gamma device, similarly tweaked, if not totally vexed. In any case, the top and bottom, left and right symmetries and asymmetries of Loos's semi-detached double houses and Marjorie Wellish's diptychs must have been similarly conceived. And actually, Loos's little double house, already by itself an architectural diptych, was built as a brace of two. Thanks. Carrying.
A few questions. Maybe I'll start with
I should keep the
question about the diptychs, going back to the functionality of the object you can think of some of the auto pieces you've shown. There was this idea of carrying the portable auto. And I was wondering whether in all these forms you've shown, there wasn't something like a trace of the fold which allows one to carry, not physically, but maybe mentally, something that can be in a way folded on itself and dividing in itself more or less endlessly so that it can be in a way seen.
And an irreducibly physical division.
Yeah
it's an interesting question because I would say that the most extreme piece of opposite evidence is the arbitrary introduction of the splits into the photograph, to make it even more pictorial. That would be the strongest piece of evidence that it's such a convention that it's willfully adopted even where it's unnecessary, or would have struck early viewers of photography as a strange impediment. Why should anyone want to do that? And it would seem an inadequate answer then to say that that's the way altarpieces look like. Because it must in turn be something deeper, such as that's the way picture, it makes it more of a picture. You know? But it's an interesting question to ask. The Marotta altarpiece would be part of the answer because of the pun on the hinge. because the metaphorical hinge coincides with the literal hinge there. And Campin must, it's too great not for that to happen by accident. Let me concentrate on that one, because there you have a very interesting problem of metaphor and metonymy. Because you could, because of that pun, even though the patron is outside the building, he's connected continuously with the inside of the building because a door belongs to both. But at the right, in the right-hand panel is St. Joseph making the mousetrap, which Shapiro explains is itself a kind of metonymical metaphor, because it's a mousetrap for the devil. It's really a cross, in other words, even though it looks like a mousetrap, you know? So that's already got its own metaphor and metonymy problem. But the important thing for this question is nobody would ever assume that that room where the carpentry work is being done is right behind the room where the Virgin is, partly because there's a big fireplace right there. And it doesn't seem, that doesn't seem to Weber where the workshop would be, even though on the other side, it's absolutely free, continuous, like here's outside and here's inside. So even though you have on the left an outside versus an inside, and on the right you have an inside and an inside, the inside and the inside are much more contradictory than the outside and on the left. That's an approach to an answer, because it wouldn't be as strong an ambiguity. It would not be as strong an ambiguity without the pun on the literal hinge. And the opposite extreme would be the photograph where there's absolutely no reason to put those slits in, except you want to make it look like art. Because it's already as pictorial as anything.
Mm-hmm. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jean.
Some more questions that they introduce the second speaker.